This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Story of the Lost Child by Elena Ferrante, translated by Anne Goldstein. This book is read by Hilary Huber. 1. From October 1976 until 1979, when I returned to Naples to live, I avoided resuming a steady relationship with Leela, but it wasn't easy. She almost immediately tried to re-enter my life by force, and I ignored her, tolerated her, endured her. Even if she acted as if there were nothing she wanted more than to be close to me at a difficult moment, I couldn't forget the contempt with which she had treated me. Today, I think that if it had been only the insult that wounded me, "You're an idiot," she had shouted on the telephone when I told her about Nino, and she had never, ever spoken to me like that before, I would have soon calmed down. In reality, what mattered more than that offense was the mention of Dede and Elsa. "Think of the harm you're doing to your daughters," she had warned me, and at the moment, I had paid no attention. But over time, those words acquired greater weight, and I returned to them often. Leela had never displayed the slightest interest in Dede and Elsa. Almost certainly, she didn't even remember their names. If, on the phone, I mentioned some intelligent remark they had made, she cut me off, changed the subject. And when she met them for the first time, at the house of Marcello Salata, she had confined herself to an absent-minded glance and a few pat phrases. She hadn't paid the least attention to how nicely they were dressed, how neatly their hair was combed, how well both were able to express themselves, although they were still small. And yet I had given birth to them. I had brought them up. They were part of me, who had been her friend forever. She should have taken this into account. I won't say out of affection, but at least out of politeness, for my maternal pride. Yet she hadn't even attempted a little good-natured sarcasm. She had displayed indifference and nothing more. Only now, out of jealousy, surely, because I had taken Nino, did she remember the girls and wanted to emphasize that I was a terrible mother. That although I was happy, I was causing them unhappiness. The minute I thought about it, I became anxious. Had Leela worried about Gennaro when she left Stefano, when she abandoned the child to the neighbor because of her work in the factory, when she sent him to me as if to get him out of the way? Ah, I had my faults, but I was certainly more a mother than she was. 2. Such thoughts became a habit in those years. It was as if Leela, who, after all, had uttered only that one malicious remark about Dede and Elsa, had become the defense lawyer for their needs as daughters. And every time I neglected them to devote myself to myself, I felt obliged to prove to her that she was wrong. But it was a voice invented by ill feeling. What she really thought of my behavior as a mother, I don't know. Only she can say if, in fact, she has managed to insert herself into this extremely long chain of words to modify my text, to purposely supply the missing links, to unhook others without letting it show, to say of me more than I want, more than I'm able to say. I wish for this intrusion. I've hoped for it ever since I began to write our story. But I have to get to the end in order to check all the pages. If I tried now, I would certainly get stuck. I've been writing for too long, and I'm tired. It's more and more difficult to keep the thread of the story taut within the chaos of the years, of events large and small, of moods. So either I tend to pass over my own affairs to recapture Leela and all the complications she brings with her. Or worse, I let myself be carried away by the events of my life, only because it's easier to write them. But I have to avoid this choice. I mustn't take the first path on which, if I set myself aside, I would end up finding ever fewer traces of Leela, since the very nature of our relationship dictates that I can reach her only by passing through myself. But I shouldn't take the second either. That, in fact, I speak of my experience in increasingly greater detail is just what she would certainly favor. "Come on," she would say. "Tell us what turn your life took. Who cares about mine? Admit that it doesn't even interest you." And she would conclude, "I'm a scribble on a scribble, completely unsuitable for one of your books. Forget it, Lenu. One doesn't tell the story of an erasure." What to do then? Admit yet again that she's right? Accept that to be adult is to disappear? Is to learn to hide to the point of vanishing? Admit that, as the years pass, the less I know of Leela? This morning I keep weariness at bay and sit down again at the desk. Now that I'm close to the most painful part of our story, I want to seek on the page a balance between her and me that in life I couldn't find even between myself and me. 3. Of the days in Montpellier, I remember everything except the city. It's as if I'd never been there. Outside the hotel, outside the vast assembly hall where the academic conference that Nina was attending took place, today I see only a windy autumn and a blue sky resting on white clouds. And yet, in my memory, that place name, Montpellier, has for many reasons remained a symbol of escape. I had been out of Italy once, in Paris, with Franco, and I had felt exhilarated by my own audacity. But then it seemed to me that my world was, and would forever remain, the neighborhood, Naples, while the rest was like a brief outing in whose special climate I could imagine myself as I would never in fact be. Montpellier, on the other hand, although it was far less exciting than Paris, gave me the impression that my boundaries had burst and I was expanding. The pure and simple fact of being in that place constituted, in my eyes, the proof that the neighborhood, Naples, Pisa, Florence, Milan, Italy itself, were only tiny fragments of the world, and that I would do well not to be satisfied with those fragments any longer. In Montpellier, I felt the limitations of my outlook, of the language in which I expressed myself and in which I had written. In Montpellier, it seemed to me evident how restrictive, at 32, being a wife and mother might be. And in all those days charged with love, I felt, for the first time, freed from the chains I had accumulated over the years, those of my origins, those I had acquired through academic success, those derived from the choices I had made in life, especially marriage. There I also understood the reasons for the pleasure I had felt, in the past, on seeing my first book translated into other languages, and, at the same time, the reasons for my disappointment at finding few readers outside Italy. It was marvelous to cross borders, to let oneself go within other cultures, discover the provisional nature of what I had taken for absolute. The fact that Leela had never been out of Naples, and that she was afraid even of San Giovanni a Tiduccio, if, in the past, I had judged it an arguable choice that she was nevertheless able, as usual, to turn into an advantage, now seemed to me simply a sign of mental limitation. I reacted the way you do to someone who insults you by using the same formulations that offended you. "You were wrong about me?" "No, my dear. It's I, who was wrong about you. You will spend the rest of your life looking out at the trucks passing on the Stradone. The days flew by. The organizers of the conference had reserved for Nino a single room in the hotel, and since I had decided so late to go with him, there was no way to change it to a double. So we had separate rooms, but every night I took a shower, got ready for bed, and then, with trepidation, went to his room. We slept together, clinging to each other, as if we feared that a hostile force would separate us in sleep. In the morning, we had breakfast in bed, a luxury that I had seen only in movies. We laughed. We were happy. During the day, I went with him to the assembly hall, and although the speakers read their endless pages in a bored tone, being with him was exciting. I sat next to him, but without disturbing him. Nino followed the talks attentively, took notes, and every so often whispered in my ear ironic comments and words of love. At lunch and dinner, we mixed with academics from all over the world, foreign names, foreign languages. Of course, the participants with bigger reputations were at a table of their own. We sat in a large group of younger scholars. But I was struck by Nino's mobility, both during the events and at the restaurants. How different he was from the student of long ago, even from the youth who had defended me in the bookstore in Milan almost 10 years earlier. He had abandoned polemical tones. He tactfully crossed academic barriers, established relations with a serious yet engaging demeanor. Now in English, excellent. Now in French, good. He conversed brilliantly, displaying his old devotion to figures and efficiency. I was filled with pride at how well-liked he was. In a few hours, he had charmed everyone and was invited here and there. There was a single moment when he changed abruptly. The evening before he was to speak at the conference, he became aloof and rude. He seemed overwhelmed by anxiety. He began to disparage the text he had prepared. He kept repeating that writing for him wasn't as easy as it was for me. He became angry because he hadn't had time to work well. I felt guilty. Was it our complicated affair that had distracted him? And tried to help, hugging him, kissing him, urging him to read me the pages. He did read them, with the air of a frightened schoolboy, which touched me. To me, the speech seemed as dull as the ones I had heard in the assembly hall, but I praised it, and he calmed down. The next morning, he performed with practiced warmth and was applauded. That evening, one of the big-name academics, an American, invited him to sit with him. I was left alone, but I wasn't sorry. When Nino was there, I didn't talk to anyone. While in his absence, I was forced to manage with my halting French, and I became friendly with a couple from Paris. I liked them because I quickly discovered that they were in a situation not very different from ours. Both considered the institution of the family suffocating. Both had painfully left spouses and children. Both seemed happy. He, Augustin, was around 50, with a ruddy face, lively blue eyes, a bushy pale blonde mustache. She, Colombe, was a little over 30, like me. She had very short black hair, eyes and lips drawn sharply on a tiny face, a charming elegance. I talked mainly to Colombe, who had a child of 7. In a few months, I said, my older daughter will turn 7. But she's going into second grade this year. She's very bright. My son is extremely clever and imaginative. How did he take the separation? Fine. He didn't get even a little upset? Children aren't rigid the way we are. They're flexible. She dwelled on the flexibility she ascribed to childhood. It seemed to reassure her. She added, "In our world, it's fairly common for parents to separate, and children know it's possible." But just as I was saying that I didn't know other separated women, apart from one friend, her tone changed abruptly, and she began to complain about the child. "He's smart but slow," she exclaimed. "At school, they say he's unruly." I was struck by the change. She expressed herself without tenderness, almost bitterly, as if her son were behaving like that to spite her, and this made me anxious. Her companion must have noticed, and he interrupted, boasting about his two boys, 14 and 18, and joking about how attractive they were to women, both old and young. When Nino returned, the two men, especially Augustin, began to criticize the speakers. Colombe joined in almost immediately, with a slightly artificial gaiety. The maliciousness soon created a bond. Augustin talked and drank a lot all evening. His companion laughed whenever Nino managed to say a word. They invited us to drive to Paris with them, in their car. The conversation about children and that invitation that we didn't say yes or no to brought me back to reality. Until that moment, Dede and Elsa, and also Pietro, had been on my mind constantly, but as if suspended in a parallel universe, motionless around the kitchen table in Florence, or in front of the television, or in their beds. Suddenly, my world and theirs were back in communication. I realized that the days in Montpellier were about to end, that inevitably Nino and I would return to our homes, that we would have to face our respective marital crises, I in Florence, he in Naples. And the children's bodies rejoined mine. I felt the contact violently. I had no news of them for 5 days, and as I became aware of that, I felt an intense nausea, an unbearable longing for them. I was afraid not of the future in general, which now seemed inescapably occupied by Nino, but of the hours that were about to come, of tomorrow, of the day after. I couldn't resist, and although it was almost midnight, "What's the difference?" I said to myself. "Pietro is always awake." I tried to telephone. It was fairly laborious, but finally the call went through. "Hello," I said. "Hello," I repeated. I knew that Pietro was at the other end of the line. I called him by name. "Pietro, it's Elena. How are the girls?" The connection was cut off. I waited a few minutes, then I asked the operator to call again. I was determined to continue all night, but this time Pietro answered. "What do you want?"
"Tell me about the children."
"They're sleeping."
"I know, but how are they?"
"What is it to you?"
"They're my children."
"You left them. They don't want to be your children anymore."
"They told you?"
"They told my mother."
"You had Adele come?"
"Yes."
"Tell them I'll be home in a few days."
"No, don't come back. Neither I nor the children, nor my mother wants to see you again."
4. I had a cry. Then I calmed down and went to Nino. I wanted to tell him about that phone call. I wanted him to console me. But as I was about to knock on his door, I heard him talking to someone. I hesitated. He was on the phone. I couldn't understand what he was saying, or even what language he was speaking. But right away, I thought that he was talking to his wife. So, did this happen every evening? When I went to my room to get ready for the night, and he was alone, he telephoned Eleonora? Were they looking for a way to separate without fighting? Or were they reconciling, and once the interlude of Montpellier was over, she would take him back?
I decided to knock. Nino broke off. Silence. Then he began talking again, but lowered his voice. I became nervous. I knocked again. Nothing happened. I had to knock a third time, hard, before he came to the door. I immediately confronted him. I accused him of hiding me from his wife. I cried that I had telephoned Pietro, that my husband didn't want to let me see my children, that I was calling into question my entire life while he was cooing on the telephone with Eleonora. It was a terrible night of quarreling. We struggled to make up. Nino tried everything to soothe me. He laughed nervously. He got angry at Pietro for the way he had treated me. He kissed me. I pushed him away. He said I was crazy. But no matter how I pressed him, he never admitted that he was talking to his wife. In fact, he swore on his son that since the day he left Naples, he hadn't talked to her. Then who are you calling?
A colleague here in the hotel.
At midnight?
At midnight.
Liar.
It's the truth.
I refused for a long time to make love. I couldn't. I was afraid that he no longer loved me. Then I yielded, in order not to have to believe that it was all already over. The next morning, for the first time in almost 5 days of living together, I woke in a bad mood. We had to leave. The conference was nearly over. But I didn't want Montpellier to be merely an interlude. I was afraid to go home, afraid that Nino would go home, afraid of losing my children forever. When Augustin and Colombe again suggested that we drive to Paris with them, and even offered to put us up, I turned to Nino, hoping that he, too, wanted nothing more than the chance to extend this time, put off the return. But he shook his head sadly. He said,
"Impossible. We have to go back to Italy."
And he talked about flights, tickets, trains, money. I was fragile. I felt disappointment and rancor. I was right, I thought. He lied to me. The break with his wife isn't conclusive. He had talked to her every night. He had pledged to return home after the conference. He couldn't delay even a couple of days. And me? I remembered the publisher in Nanterre and my short scholarly story about the male invention of woman. Until that moment, I hadn't talked about myself to anyone, even Nino. I had been the smiling but nearly mute woman who slept with the brilliant professor from Naples. The woman always pasted to him, attentive to his needs, to his thoughts. But now I said with false cheer, "It's Nino who has to return. I have an engagement in Nanterre. A work of mine is about to come out, or maybe it's already out. A half essay, half story. I just might leave with you and stop in at the publisher's." The two looked at me as if only at that moment had I actually begun to exist, and they went on to ask me about my work. I told them, and it turned out that Colombe knew well the woman who was the head of the small, but, as I discovered at that moment, prestigious publishing house. I let myself go. I talked with too much vivacity, and maybe I exaggerated a little about my literary career. I did it not for the two French people, but, rather, for Nino. I wanted to remind him that I had a rewarding life of my own, that if I had been capable of leaving my children and Pietro, then I could also do without him, and not in a week, not in 10 days, immediately. He listened, then he said seriously to Colombe and Augustin, "All right. If it's not a bother for you, we'll take advantage of the ride." But when we were alone, he made me a speech anxious in tone and passionate in content, whose sense was that I should trust him. that although our situation was complicated, we would surely untangle it. That to do so, however, we had to go home. We couldn't flee from Montpellier to Paris, and then to who knows what other city. We had to confront our spouses and begin our life together. Suddenly, I felt that he was not only reasonable, but sincere. I was confused. I embraced him. I murmured agreement. And yet we left for Paris. I wanted just a few more days. 5. It was a long trip. There was a strong wind and sometimes rain. The landscape had a rust-caked pallor. But at times the sky broke and everything became brilliant, starting with the rain. I clung to Nino and now and then fell asleep on his shoulder. I began again to feel, with pleasure, that I was far beyond my margins. I liked the foreign language that echoed in the car. I was pleased that I was heading in the direction of a book that I had written in Italian, and that, thanks to Maria Rosa, was being published first in another language. What an extraordinary fact. How many amazing things were happening to me. That little volume was like a rock that I had hurled along an unpredictable trajectory, and at a speed that had no comparison with that of the rocks that his girls, Leela and I, had thrown at the gangs of boys. But the journey wasn't always pleasant. Sometimes I became sad. And I quickly formed the impression that Nino was talking to Colombe in a tone that he didn't use with Augustin. Not to mention that too often he touched her shoulder with his fingertips. My bad mood gradually worsened, as I saw the two of them were getting very friendly. When we arrived in Paris, they were the best of friends, chatting away. She laughed often, smoothing her hair with a careless gesture. Augustin lived in a nice apartment on Canal Saint-Martin. Colombe had recently moved in. Even after they showed us our room, they wouldn't let us go to bed. It seemed to me that they were afraid to be alone. They wouldn't stop talking. I was tired and nervous. I was the one who had wanted to go to Paris, and now it seemed absurd to be in that house, among strangers, far from my daughters, with Nino paying scant attention to me. Once in the room, I asked him, "Do you like Colombe?" "She's nice." I asked if you like her. "Do you want to quarrel?" "No." "Then think about it. How can I like Colombe if I love you?" It scared me when his tone became even slightly harsh. I was afraid I would have to acknowledge that something between us wasn't working. "He is simply nice to anyone who has been nice to us," I said to myself, and fell asleep. But I slept badly. At one point, I had the impression that I was alone in the bed. I tried to wake up, but was drawn back into sleep. I emerged again some time later. Nino now was standing in the dark, or so it seemed to me. "Sleep," he said. I fell asleep again. The next day, our hosts took us to Nanterre. The whole way, Nino continued to joke with Colombe, to talk to her in an elusive way. I tried not to pay attention. How could I think of living with him if I had to spend my time watching him? When we reached our destination, and he became genial and charming with Maria Rosa's friend, the owner of the publishing house, and her partner, one around 40, the other 60, I drew a sigh of relief. "It's innocent," I concluded. "He's like that with all women." And finally, I felt better. The two women greeted me warmly, full of praise, and asked about Maria Rosa. I knew that my volume had only just arrived in the bookstores, but already a couple of reviews had appeared. The older woman showed them to me. She seemed amazed herself at how positive they were. And turning to Colombe, to Augustin,
to Nino.
She kept repeating it. I read the articles. Two lines here, four there. They were written by women. I had never heard of them. But Colombe and the two women had, and they praised the book enthusiastically. I should have been pleased. The day before, I had been compelled to sing my own praises, and now I no longer needed to. Yet I found that I couldn't feel excited. It was as if, since I loved Nino and he loved me, that love made everything good that happened to me and would happen to me nothing but a pleasant secondary effect. I showed my satisfaction graciously and gave a feeble assent to my publisher's plans for promotion. "You'll have to return soon," the older woman exclaimed.
"Or at least we hope so."
The younger added, "Maria Rosa told us about your marital crisis. We hope you'll come out of it without too much suffering." In this way, I discovered that the news of the break between me and Pietro had reached not only Adele, but Milan, and even France. Better that way, I thought. It will be easier to make the separation permanent. I said to myself, "I'll take what's mine, and I mustn't live in fear of losing Nino. I mustn't worry about Dede and Elsa. I'm fortunate. He will always love me.
My daughters are my daughters.
Everything will work out." 6. We returned to Rome. We promised each other everything as we said goodbye. We did nothing but promise. Then Nino left for Naples, and I for Florence. I returned home almost on tiptoe, convinced that one of the most difficult trials of my life awaited me. Instead, the children greeted me with apprehensive joy and began tagging after me through the house, not only Elsa, but Dede too, as if they were afraid that if they lost sight of me, I would disappear again. Adele was polite and didn't mention even once the situation that had brought her to my house. Pietro, very pale, confined himself to handing me a piece of paper with a list of phone calls for me. Lila's name appeared at least four times. Muttered that he had to go to work, and 2 hours later had disappeared, without even saying goodbye to his mother or the children. It took a few days for Adele to manifest her opinion plainly. She wanted me to return to myself and to my husband. But it took several weeks to convince her that I really didn't want either of those things. In that time, she never raised her voice, never lost her temper, didn't even comment sarcastically about my frequent long phone calls to Nino. She was more interested in the phone calls from the two women in Nanterre, who were keeping me informed of the progress of the book and of a calendar of engagements that would lead to a tour in France. She wasn't surprised at the positive reviews in the French papers. She was sure that the book would soon get the same attention in Italy. She said that in our papers, she would have been able to obtain better. Above all, she insistently praised my intelligence, my education, my courage, and on no account did she defend her son, who, besides, was never around. I assumed that Pietro did not really have work obligations outside of Florence. Rather, I was immediately convinced, with rage and even a hint of contempt, that he had entrusted the resolution of our crisis to his mother, and was holed up somewhere to work on his interminable book. Once, I couldn't contain myself, and I said to Adele, "It was really difficult to live with your son."
"There's no man it's not difficult to live with."
"With him, believe me, it's been especially difficult."
"You think it will go better with Nino?"
"Yes."
"I've asked around. The talk about him in Milan is very nasty."
"I don't need the talk of Milan. I've loved him for 20 years, and you can spare me the gossip. I know more about him than anyone else."
"How you like saying you love him," Why shouldn't I like it?
You're right. Why? I was wrong. It's pointless to open the eyes of someone in love.
From then on, we stopped talking about Nino. And when I left the girls with her to rush to Naples, she didn't bat an eye. She didn't bat an eye even when I told her that, when I returned from Naples, I would have to go to France and would be there for a week. She asked only, with a slightly ironic inflection, "Will you be here for Christmas? Will you be with the children?" The question almost offended me. I answered, "Of course." I filled my suitcase mainly with elegant underwear and stylish dresses. At the announcement of my new departure, Dede and Elsa, who never asked about their father, even though they hadn't seen him for a long time, were extremely upset. Dede went so far as to yell words that were surely not hers. "Go, get out, you're mean and hateful." I glanced at Adele, hoping that she would try to get her to play and distract her, but she did nothing. When they saw me go to the door, they began to cry. Elsa started it, shrieking, "I want to come with you." Dede resisted. She tried to show me all her indifference, maybe even her scorn, but finally she gave in and became even more desperate than her sister. I had to tear myself away from them. They held on to my dress. They wanted me to leave the suitcase. Their cries pursued me to the street. The trip to Naples seemed very long. Nearing the city, I looked out the window. As the train slowed down, sliding into the urban space, I was seized by an anxious exhaustion. I noticed the ugliness of the periphery, with the small gray apartment buildings beyond the tracks, the pylons, the lights of the signals, the stone parapets. When the train entered the station, it seemed to me that the Naples I felt bound to, the Naples I was returning to, was now summed up only in Nino. I knew that he was in worse trouble than I was. Eleonora had thrown him out of the house. For him, too, everything had become provisional. For several weeks he had been staying at the house of a university colleague who lived near the Duomo. Where would he take me? What would we do? And above all, what decisions would we make, since we hadn't the least idea of a concrete solution to our situation? The only thing clear to me was that I was burning with desire. I couldn't wait to see him. I got out of the train terrified that something had kept him from coming to meet me. But he was there. Tall as he was, he stood out in the stream of travelers. This reassured me, and I was even more reassured to find that he had taken a room in a small hotel in Mergellina, thus showing that he had no intention of hiding me in his friend's house. We were mad with love. The time flew. In the evening, we walked along the sea, clinging to each other. He put an arm around my shoulders, and every so often leaned over to kiss me. I tried in every way possible to persuade him to go to France with me. He was tempted, then retreated, taking refuge behind his work at the university. He never spoke of Eleonora or Albertino, as if the mere mention of them could ruin the joy of our being together. I instead told him about the girl's desperation. I said we had to find a solution as quickly as possible. I felt he was nervous. I was sensitive to the slightest tension. I was afraid that at any moment he might say, "I can't do it. I'm going home." But I was wide of the mark. When we went to dinner, he revealed what the problem was. He said, becoming suddenly serious, that there was some vexing news. "Let's hear it," I whispered. "This morning, Lena called me." "Ah, she wants to see us."
7.
The evening was spoiled. Nino said it was my mother-in-law who had told Leela that I was in Naples. He spoke with great embarrassment, choosing his words carefully, emphasizing points like, she didn't have my address. She asked my sister for the phone number of my colleague. She telephoned a little before I was about to leave for the station. I didn't tell you right away, because I was afraid you would get angry and our day would be ruined.
He concluded, desolate,
you know what she's like. I've never been able to say no to her. We have an appointment with her tomorrow at 11. She'll be at the entrance to the metro at Piazza Amedeo.
I couldn't control myself. How long have you been back in touch? Have you seen each other?
What are you talking about?
Absolutely not. I don't believe you.
Elena, I swear I haven't talked to or seen Leela since 1963.
You know the child wasn't yours.
She told me this morning.
So you talked for a long time, and about intimate things.
She was the one who brought up the child.
And you? In all this time, you were never curious to know more about it?
It's my problem. I don't see the need to discuss it.
Your problems are also mine now. We have a lot to talk about. Time is short. And I didn't leave my children to waste it with Leela. How could it possibly have occurred to you to make this date?
I thought it would please you. But there's the telephone. Call your friend and tell her we have a lot to do. You can't see her.
There. Suddenly he lost patience. I was silent. Yes, I knew what Leela was like. Ever since I returned to Florence, she had been calling often. But I had other things to think about, and not only did I always hang up, I had also asked Adele, if she happened to answer, to say that I wasn't home. Leela, however, hadn't given up. It was therefore likely that she had found out from Adele about my presence in Naples, likely that she had taken for granted that I would not go to the neighborhood, likely that, to see me, she had found a way of getting in touch with Nino. What was the harm? And above all, what did I expect? I had always known that he had loved Leela and that Leela had loved him. So, it had happened long ago, and to be jealous was inappropriate. I slowly caressed his hand. I murmured, "All right, tomorrow we'll go to Piazza Amedeo." We ate, and he talked for a long time about our future. Nino made me promise that I would ask for a separation as soon as I returned from France. Meanwhile, he assured me that he had already been in touch with a lawyer friend of his, and that even if it was all complicated, and certainly Eleonora and her relatives would make things hard for him, he had decided to go ahead.
"You know," he said, "here in Naples, these things are more difficult. When it comes to a backward mentality and bad manners, my wife's relatives are no different from mine and yours, even if they have money and are high-ranking professionals."
And, as if to explain himself better, he began to speak well of my in-laws.
"Unfortunately," he exclaimed, "I'm not dealing, as you are, with respectable people. Like the Airotas.
People he described as having grand cultural traditions, admirable civility." I listened, but now Leela was there between us, at our table, and I couldn't push her away. While Nino talked, I remembered the trouble she had got herself in just to be with him, heedless of what Stefano could do to her, or her brother, or Michele Solara. And the mention of our parents for a fraction of a second brought me back to Ischia, to the evening on the beach of the Maronti, Leela with Nino in Forio, I on the damp sand with Donato, and I felt horror. This, I thought, is a secret that I will never be able to tell him. How many words remain unsayable, even between a couple in love, and how the risk is increased that others might say them, destroying it. His father and I, he and Leela.
I tore away revulsion. I mentioned Pietro, what he was suffering.
Nino flared up. It was his turn to be jealous. I tried to reassure him. He demanded clean breaks and full stops. I demanded them too. They seemed to us indispensable to the start of a new life. We discussed when, where. Work chained Nino inescapably to Naples. The children chained me to Florence.
Come and live here, he said suddenly. Move as soon as you can.
Impossible. Pietro has to be able to see the children.
Take turns. You'll take them to him the next time he'll come here.
He won't agree.
He'll agree.
The evening went on like that. The more we examined the question, the more complicated it seemed. The more we imagined a life together, every day, every night, the more we desired it, and the difficulties vanished. Meanwhile, in the empty restaurant, the waiters whispered to each other, yawned. Nino paid, and we went back along the sea walk, which was still lively. For a moment, as I looked at the dark water and smelled its odor, it seemed that the neighborhood was much farther away than when I had gone to Pisa, to Florence. Even Naples, suddenly, seemed very far from Naples. And Leela from Leela. I felt that beside me, I had not her, but my own anxieties. Only Nino and I were close, very close. I whispered in his ear, "Let's go to bed." 8. The next day I got up early and shut myself in the bathroom. I took a long shower. I dried my hair carefully, worrying that the hotel hairdryer, which blew violently, would give it the wrong wave. A little before 10, I woke Nino, who, still dazed by sleep, was full of compliments for my dress. He tried to pull me down beside him. I drew back. Although I made an effort to pretend there was nothing wrong, I had trouble forgiving him. He had transformed our new day of love into Leela's day. And now the time was completely, indelibly marked by that looming encounter. I dragged him to breakfast. He followed submissively. He didn't laugh. He didn't tease me. He said, touching my hair with his fingertips, "You look very nice." Evidently, he perceived that I was anxious, and I was. I was afraid that Leela would arrive looking her best. I was made as I was made. She was elegant by nature. And besides, she had new money. If she wanted, she could take care of herself as she had done as a girl with Stefano's money. I didn't want Nino to be dazzled by her again. We left around 10:30, in a cold wind. We walked, unhurried, toward Piazza Amedeo. I was shivering, even though I was wearing a heavy coat and he had an arm around my shoulders. We never mentioned Leela. Nino talked in a somewhat artificial way about how Naples had improved now that there was a communist mayor. And he began pressing me again to join him as soon as possible with the children. He held me close as we walked, and I hoped he would keep holding me until we reached the subway station. I wanted Leela to be at the metro entrance, to see us from a distance, to find us handsome, to be forced to think, a perfect couple. But a few meters from the meeting place, he released his arm, lighted a cigarette. I took his hand instinctively, squeezed it hard, and we entered the piazza like that. I didn't see Leela right away, and for a moment I hoped she hadn't come. And then I heard her call me. She called me in her usual imperative way,
as though it could never even occur to her that I wouldn't hear her, wouldn't turn, wouldn't obey her voice. She was in the doorway of the cafe opposite the metro tunnel, her hands stuck in the pockets of an ugly brown coat, thinner than usual, slightly bent, her shining black hair traversed by trails of silver and tied in a ponytail. She seemed to me the usual Leela, the adult Leela, a Leela marked by the factory experience. She had done nothing to dress up. She hugged me tight in an intense embrace that I returned without energy. Then she kissed me on the cheeks with two sharp smacks and a contented laugh. She held out her hand to Nino absently. We sat inside the cafe. She did almost all the talking and addressed me as if we were alone. She immediately confronted my hostility, which evidently she read in my face, and said, affectionately, smiling, "All right, I was wrong. I offended you. But now, enough. How is it that you've become so touchy? You know that I like everything about you. Let's make up." I avoided her with tepid half-smiles. I didn't say yes or no. She was sitting opposite Nino, but she never looked or spoke to him. She was there for me. Once, she took my hand, but I quietly withdrew it. She wanted us to be reconciled. She intended to reinstate herself in my life again, even if she didn't agree with the direction I was taking it. I realized this from the way she added question to question without paying attention to the answers. She was so eager to reoccupy every corner that she had scarcely touched on one subject when she immediately went on to another. "With Pietro?" "Badly." "And your daughters?" "They're well." "You'll get divorced?" "Yes." "And you two will live together?" "Yes." "Where? What city?" "I don't know." "Come back here to live." "It's complicated." "I'll find you an apartment." "If it's necessary, I'll let you know."
"Are you writing?"
"I've published a book."
"Another?"
"Yes."
"No one said anything about it?"
"For now, it's only come out in France."
"In French?"
"Yes."
"A novel?"
"A story. But it has a thesis."
"What's it about?"
I was vague. I cut her off. I preferred to ask about Enzo, about Gennaro, about the neighborhood, about her work. At the mention of her son, she took on a look of amusement and declared that I would see him soon. He was still at school now, but he was coming with Enzo, and there would also be a nice surprise. About the neighborhood, on the other hand, she assumed an attitude of indifference. Alluding to the terrible death of Manuela Solara and the turmoil it had unleashed, she said,
"It's nothing. People are murdered here the way they are everywhere in Italy."
Then, surprisingly, she mentioned my mother, praising her energy and her resourcefulness, even though she was well aware of our turbulent relationship. And, just as surprisingly, she seemed affectionate toward her own parents. She said that she was putting money aside to buy the apartment where they had always lived to give them some peace of mind.
"It's a pleasure for me,"
she explained, as if she had to apologize for that generosity.
"I was born there. I'm attached to it. And if Enzo and I work hard, we can afford it."
She worked as much as 12 hours a day now, not only for Michele Solara, but also for other clients.
"I'm studying," she said. "A new machine, the System 32. Much better than the one I showed you when you came to Acera. It's a white case that incorporates a tiny 6-inch monitor, a keyboard, and a printer."
She talked on and on about more advanced systems that were coming. She was very well informed. As usual, she got excited about the new things, even though she'd be sick of them in a few days. The new machine had a beauty of its own, according to her.
"Too bad," she said,
that apart from the machine, everything was shit. At that point, Nino broke in and did exactly the opposite of what, until that moment, I had done. He began to give her detailed information. He spoke with excitement about my book. He said that it was coming out soon in Italy, too. He cited the success of the French reviews. He pointed out that I had a lot of problems with my husband and my daughters. He talked about his break with his wife. He repeated that the only solution was to live in Naples. He even encouraged her to find us a house. He asked some knowledgeable questions about her and Enzo's work. I listened somewhat apprehensively. His manner as he spoke was distant, to show me, first, that he really hadn't seen Leela before, and second, that she no longer had any influence over him. And not for an instant did he use the seductive tones that he had used with Colomb, and which habitually came to him with women. He didn't invent sentimental locutions. He never looked her straight in the eye. He didn't touch her. His voice became a little warmer only when he praised me. This didn't prevent me from remembering the beach at Chitara, and how he and Leela had made use of the most varied subjects to reach an understanding and cut me out. But it seemed to me that now the opposite was happening. Even when they asked each other questions and answered them, they ignored each other and addressed me, as if I were their only interlocutor. They went on talking for a good half hour without agreeing about anything. I was surprised especially by the way they insisted on their differences about Naples. My political knowledge was by now feeble. The care of the children, the study in preparation for my little book, the writing of it, and, above all, the upheaval of my personal life had kept me even from reading the newspaper. The two of them, on the other hand, knew everything about everything. Nino listed names of Neapolitan communists and socialists he knew well and trusted. He praised an administration that, finally, was honest, led by a mayor whom he called respectable, likable, a stranger to the usual old corruption. He concluded, "Now, at last, there are good reasons to live and work here. This is a great opportunity. We have to be a part of it." But Leela made sarcastic comments about everything he said. "Naples," she said, "is disgusting, exactly as it was before. And if you're not teaching the monarchists, fascists, and Christian Democrats a good lesson for all the filthy things they've done, if you just forget about it as the left is doing, soon the shopkeepers," she laughed a little harshly after saying the word, "will take back the city, along with the city bureaucracy, the lawyers, the accountants, the banks, and the Camorrists." I was quickly forced to realize that even at the center of that discussion, they had put me. They both wanted me to return to Naples, but each was openly intent on detaching me from the influence of the other, and was urging me to move to the city that each was imagining. Nino's was at peace and heading toward good government. Leela's was taking revenge on all the predators. It didn't give a damn about communists and socialists. It was starting over from zero. I studied them the whole time. It struck me that, the more complex the themes that emerged in the conversation, the more Leela tended to unfold her secret Italian, which I knew she was capable of, but which on that occasion astonished me. Because every sentence demonstrated that she was more cultured than she wished to appear. As for Nino, who was usually brilliant, self-confident, he chose his words warily and at times seemed intimidated. "They're both uneasy," I thought. In the past, they exposed themselves to each other openly, and now they're ashamed of having done so. What is happening at this moment? Are they deceiving me? Are they really fighting over me, or are they only trying to keep their old attraction under control? I purposely gave signs of impatience. Leela noticed. She got up.